Welcome to the deep dive. I want you listening right now to picture the most fiercely independent, self-made person you know.
Oh, we all know someone like that.
Right. Someone who prides themselves on needing absolutely no one. Like someone who claims they owe their success, their comfort, their entire life entirely to their own two hands.
Yeah, the ultimate success story.
Exactly. In our modern world, we put people like that on magazine covers. But the dense and incredibly fascinating text we are diving into today argues that this exact mindset, this fierce pursuit of total self-sufficiency, is actually the psychological seed of ultimate darkness.
It really is a complete inversion of how we usually think about ethics. I mean, normally, if you or I want to understand a religious system, we study its saints.
Yeah, we look at the heroes.
Exactly. We look at its highest virtues. We
Yeah.
study the light.
But the source material we are unpacking today takes the complete opposite approach. We are looking at excerpts from a book titled Ethico-Religious Concepts in the Quran. And the core argument here is that if you actually want to understand Islamic ethics, and specifically the concept of faith, which is iman, you cannot start with the light.
No, you really can't.
You
You're
have to understand the dark gravity around which all other negative human qualities orbit. You have to look at the concept of kufr. So, okay, let's unpack this.
right. And we're going to explore this not as some simple theological binary, because I think people hear the word and think it's just a checklist of belief versus
The
disbelief.
label, basically.
Yeah, just a label. But this text lays out a profound step-by-step psychological and linguistic evolution. It is an entire anatomy of human denial. It shows how, like, everyday attitudes metastasize into something totally unrecognizable.
Let's start at the very beginning then, because if you hear the word kafir or kufr today, it usually just gets translated as infidel or disbeliever.
Right, which sounds purely theological.
Yeah, a purely theological label. But our source material takes us all the way back to the literal philological root of the word in Arabic.
Yeah, so the linguistic root is KFR.
Yeah.
And at its most basic foundational level, before it ever touches on the concept of religion or atheism or anything like that, the word simply means covering.
Covering, literally putting a physical lid over something.
Yes. But when you apply that root to human relationships, specifically the receiving of benefits, it takes on a very specific behavioral meaning. It means to cover, which is to ignore knowingly the benefits which one has received.
So to hide the favor.
Exactly. So at its absolute core, the seed of kufr is ingratitude.
So if you're listening to this on your commute, think about a time you went out of your way to do a massive favor for a friend or a coworker. You gave them your time, your money, whatever.
Yeah, your effort.
Right. And instead of saying thank you, they actively pretend you did nothing at all. It's like a friend hands you the keys to a brand new car, and instead of showing appreciation, you deliberately throw a massive tarp over the car, turn your back, and act like you bought it yourself.
Wow, yeah, throwing a tarp over it. That is exactly it.
You are actively erasing the gif.
Erasing is the operative word there. It's an aggressive act. And in the Quranic worldview, God is the ultimate giver of all benefits.
Yeah.
I mean, every single breath a human being takes, the sun, the rain, their own intellect, all of it is a boundless gift from the Creator.
So a kafir in this foundational
Is
sense.
someone who is standing in a torrential downpour of God's benevolence, yet shows absolutely no sign of gratitude. They throw the tarp over reality itself.
I feel like I know how the story goes, though. Like, we have an all-powerful creator and a completely ungrateful human. In, traditional Western tropes of monotheism, this is the part where the wrathful deity demands groveling and smites the ungrateful human.
Right, the lightning bolt from the sky.
Exactly. But how does the text actually describe God's reaction to all of this?
Well, the text pulls a detail from the Quran that completely shatters that exact trope. It points out a very rare, striking linguistic choice. The Quran actually describes God as being thankful to humans for their good works.
Wait,
Yeah.
the creator of the universe is thankful to a human being.
Yes, the Arabic word used for God's attitude toward a sincere believer is shakir, which means thankful.
That feels completely backwards to how we usually think about it.
It entirely subverts the expected power dynamic. The text explicitly states that God will never ignore the good services of a believer. God acknowledges them gratefully.
Oh, wow.
The phrasing used in the Quran actually translates to, "There will be no kufr for his efforts."
Meaning God won't be ungrateful.
Exactly. Meaning God will never show kufr or ingratitude toward a human's good deeds. The text makes it clear that kufr is an attitude fundamentally impossible for the divine to adopt.
That is profound. I want to linger on that for a second because it makes the human failure feel so much heavier.
It really does.
Think about that cosmic contrast. You have a creator who is fundamentally incapable of being unappreciative of even your smallest good deed. Meanwhile, the human is wrapping themselves in a tarp, actively ignoring the gift of their own existence. It makes the ingratitude feel so much more tragic than just breaking a rule.
It is a tragedy of perception, which brings us to the next phase of this psychological evolution. We really have to trace the semantic shift here.
Right, because how does a person go from simply not saying thank you to completely rejecting a religious reality?
How does ungratefulness morph into actual disbelief?
Exactly.
The text traces this beautifully. In the framework of the Quran, God's favors, so your hearing, your eyesight, the natural world, are also explicitly called God's signs.
So the gifts are the evidence.
Yes. They're evidence pointing toward the divine reality. If you make a psychological habit of ignoring the favors, you are simultaneously ignoring the evidence. The line between refusing to thank the Creator and refusing to acknowledge the Creator just dissolves. You blind yourself.
And the source material offers pretty concrete proof that the early Muslims understood the word this way too, right? It wasn't just about theology for them.
Oh, absolutely. A very famous hadith, which is a documented saying of the Prophet Muhammad, illustrates this perfectly. The source mentions a moment where the prophet described a vision of the fire, and he noted seeing women there who were characterized by kuf.
And the people listening were shocked by that.
They were completely shocked. They immediately asked, does that mean they disbelieved in God?
Because even back then, people assumed kufr just meant rejecting the religion outright.
Right. But the prophet clarified immediately. He said, no, the word here means they were ungrateful to their husbands and ungrateful for acts of kindness.
Wow.
Yeah, this proves that in the formative days of Islam, the core behavioral meaning of ingratitude was inextricably linked to the word, even in the most serious spiritual contexts. It is a behavioral rot that starts at home.
But hold on, here is where it gets really interesting, and I need to push back on this progression based on what else is in the text.
Okay, go ahead.
The source material notes that the kafirs, the people committing kufra, often take the side of reason. And as someone living in the modern world, taking the side of reason sounds like the correct move, you know?
Sure, it sounds perfectly logical.
The text points out they're skeptical. I mean, if someone tells me that an ordinary guy walking around eating a sandwich in the marketplace has divine authority, skepticism is just basic critical thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Why is the text framing rational skepticism as a pathology?
That is the pivotal question of the entire text.
Yeah.
It is crucial to understand how they are using reason. They aren't engaged in a genuine search for truth. They are employing what the text describes as a highly restrictive worldly logic to dismiss anything that threatens their autonomy.
A restrictive logic.
Yeah, they're constantly pricked by the thorn of reason, but it's a localized reason.
Explain that. What do you mean by a localized reason?
Well, take the doctrine of resurrection, which the text highlights. To the localized skeptical mind of a kafir, the idea of old bones and dust being reassembled into a living being is completely absurd.
Because they've never seen it happen.
Exactly. It defies their everyday observation.
Yeah.
So they reject it. They demand a standard of worldly, empirical logic that divine revelation inherently transcends. They are essentially demanding that the infinite conform to the rules of a laboratory experiment.
Okay, I see the distinction. It's not that their intellect is broken. It's that their intellect has become a defensive weapon. They are using reason to protect their worldview from anything that might obligate them to change their behavior.
Precisely. Which leads directly into the devastating physical metaphors the Quran uses for this psychological state.
The pathology of it all.
Yes. Once you start weaponizing your intellect to deny the signs, the text shifts from talking about the mind to talking about the heart. And the pathology gets incredibly visceral.
It really does. The source material lists these Quranic descriptions, and they are chilling. While a believer's heart is described as finding calm and serene rest, the kafir's heart is described as being hardened like stones.
Or harder.
Right. Actually, the text makes a point to say they are harder than stones, because at least there are some rocks out there that split open and rivers gush forth from them. These hearts are totally impermeable.
The imagery builds a picture of complete sensory deprivation. These hearts aren't just hard. The text notes they are veiled.
Covered.
Yes, there's a partition, a hijab, between them and reality. They have locks upon them.
My personal favorite metaphor from the text, or, well, maybe the most terrifying one, is the concept of rust. The Arabic word is rana.
Oh, yes, rana.
The source explains this means a rust that covers the heart little by little, accumulating from their deeds. It makes me think of plaque building up in an artery.
That's a great analogy.
It's not that you wake up one day and decide to be spiritually blind. Every time you consume a favor and suppress the urge to say thank you, you deposit a microscopic layer of plaque on your perception. Over years, the artery of the heart completely hardens.
And that slow accumulation is the true tragedy of Kufr. You physically have eyes, you physically have ears, but the text is explicit. It is not the physical eyes that are blind. It is the hearts within the bosoms.
Mm.
And because the heart is locked, all attempts to guide someone in this state become utterly futile.
The source quotes this amazing analogy for that futility. It likens a prophet trying to preach to these hardened hearts to a drover shouting at his cattle.
Yeah, a very powerful image.
Which sounds harsh at first, but let's dissect the psychology of it. Like, spiritual noise-canceling headphones. Why do they only hear noise?
Well, the cattle hear the sound vibrating in the air, but they apprehend absolutely nothing of the meaning. When a heart is locked in denial, a message of divine guidance doesn't register as wisdom or love. It registers as a threat.
Because it demands something of them.
Exactly. The ego filters out the meaning because the meaning demands submission. So the words just bounce off the rust as meaningless, irritating noise.
Which begs the question, what is the emotional engine driving all of this? I mean, if the intellect is just acting as a defense mechanism, what makes a person actively want to put on these spiritual blinders? Our source introduces two massive concepts here that cause a person to fall into dal, to go astray.
Yeah, the root causes. The first is a concept called Zan.
And what does that translate to in our modern psychology?
Zan is basically groundless conjecture.
Mm.
It is uncertain opinion or making wild assumptions that favor your own biases. In the Quranic vocabulary, the text contrasts Zan with ilm, which is unshakable knowledge based on reality.
Okay.
The text argues that when these individuals reject divine signs in the name of reason, they aren't actually standing on ilm. They are floating on Zan. They elevate their own unreliable guesswork to the status of ultimate truth simply because it's convenient.
But guesswork alone doesn't explain the malice, right? People guess wrong all the time without their hearts turning to stone. There has to be a deeper drive.
There is. And that deeper drive is the second concept, hawa. This is a heavy foundational word in the text. It translates roughly to the natural inclination of the human soul toward its base desires. It is the animal appetite, the lust for comfort, power, or, you know, freedom from consequence.
So when we strip it all down, the text is saying they don't disbelieve because the evidence is weak. They disbelieve because the evidence interferes with what they physically and emotionally want to do.
Yes.
The desire hijacks the intellect.
The text reaches a terrifying climax regarding this.
Yeah.
It describes a psychological state where a person has literally taken his hawa for his god.
Taken his hawa for his god. You are literally worshiping your own impulses.
Exactly.
You are bowing down to your own ego.
And when the ego becomes the object of worship, you lose something the source text refers to as the sense of creatureliness.
Sense of creatureliness, meaning what exactly?
You forget that you are a created being, dependent on a creator, existing within a larger moral ecosystem. You view yourself as the center of the universe, which ushers in the ultimate final manifestation of Kufr.
Absolute, unchecked arrogance.
Yeah. The text walks us through an incredible vocabulary of arrogance. You have istakbara, which means becoming puffed up with pride. It describes that sudden, violent emotion of scornful anger you feel when someone suggests you need to submit to an authority higher than yourself.
The word that really stopped me in my tracks reading the source notes was taga.
Oh, yes.
The linguistic origin of that word paints such a vivid, terrifying picture of what an unchecked ego actually looks like.
The etymology of taga is brilliant. It originates from the image of water rising so rapidly that it overflows its banks, a destructive flood.
So when you apply that to human psychology, it's this image of an ego that has swelled so massively it bursts out of its natural human limitations. You are a mortal creature, but your pride has spilled over the boundaries of reality. You are flooding the landscape of your own life.
That overflowing flood of the ego connects to the ultimate delusion in the text, istagna.
Istagna.
Istagna means to consider oneself absolutely free, totally independent, and rich enough to stand completely alone. It is the delusion of absolute self-sufficiency.
You genuinely believe you don't need the rain, you don't need the sun, and you certainly don't need the creator. You've got it all handled.
Right.
And once someone reaches that stage of delusion, how does it manifest outwardly? Because they don't just quietly disagree, do they?
No, it manifests outwardly as mocking. The Arabic term is istasa. They sneer at the divine signs. They call the revelations fairy tales of the ancients. They find the very concept of spiritual submission genuinely hilarious.
Because it's beneath them.
Mockery becomes the ultimate defense mechanism for an inflated ego.
And the text points out they love to argue. They are constantly wrangling just to be contentious.
But again, this isn't a debate rooted in a shared search for truth.
Yeah.
It is a combative debate rooted in Zan conjecture and fueled by Istakbara arrogance. They argue simply to assert their own perceived supremacy, to prove that they answer to no one.
So what does this all mean? If we pull all these threads together, the journey this text takes us on is incredible. Kufr is not a simple checkbox on a theology exam.
Far from it.
According to this deep dive into the source material, it is a complex, tragic progression. It starts with an act so ordinary every day in gratitude, throwing a tarp over a gift. That lack of gratitude slides into following your base desires, your hawa, because you refuse to answer to the giver.
Little by little.
Right, little by little, that lifestyle slowly deposits rust over the heart, locking it up. And it ends in this overflowing, arrogant flood of a delusion. You become an isolated island of your own ego, mocking anything that tries to save you.
Which brings us back to where we started and leaves us with a highly provocative parallel for the listener to consider.
The modern pursuit of success.
Think about the culture we live in today. The absolute highest ideal for so many of us is total independence. We hustle to become entirely self-sufficient, to be answerable to absolutely no one. We want to be rich enough to stand alone. That is the exact dictionary definition of istaga.
We celebrate the very thing the text identifies as the final stage of spiritual death.
According to the deep etymology and ethical framework of the Quran we've just explored, this ultimate goal of modern life isn't freedom. It is the very seed of kufr. It is the overflowing of the ego that blinds the heart to its own fragility, its own debts, and its need for grace.
It really forces you to look at your own life, doesn't it? Are the walls we spend our whole lives building to make ourselves fiercely independent actually just veils? In our desperate attempt to need no one, are we just throwing a massive tarp over our own eyes?
It is an uncomfortable question, but perhaps the most vital one we can ask ourselves.
It absolutely is. Thank you to everyone listening for joining us on this deep dive into the sources. Take a moment to reflect on the favors you might be covering up today. Keep asking those hard questions, and as always, stay curious.